Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hello and welcome to the Publicly Challenged Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Oswald, and I hope you join me on my quest for knowledge to become a better public land hunter, angler, and forager. Stick with this and who knows, maybe we will learn something together. All right, real quick before we get started on the show, I'm just going to talk about Tree Line Academy. You've heard me say it. I can't even tell you how many times. Mark Livesay is treelineacademy.net. That's treelineacademy.net. Sign up. Use the promo code PC2020. Save yourself $20. Can't say it enough. It's awesome. Amazing. Most comprehensive e-scouting course out there. Check it out for yourself. Sign up. Use promo code PC2020. And now let's get to the show. All right. So I'm sitting here and I am talking to Roger Holscher. And Roger, you want to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, Roger Holscher, just turned 34 not too long ago. I'm currently living in a town outside of Boise, Idaho. I'm originally from California. I know everybody in Idaho hates hearing that. All the Californians moving up here, but I grew up in a small town in northeastern California, northeast of Redding, in a ranching community, farming community. Grew up up there and got my start in the law enforcement after doing a bunch of different jobs, getting into that. But I've been a law enforcement officer for just about 9 years now.
So I think the way you would say it these days is you always identified as a,
yes,
as an Idahoan. Yes. So,
you know, and people give me a lot of crap for it, even at work or anytime, you know, and it's all in fun and all good, but it's the area that I grew up in was so much more rural and country than the area I live in now that I'm like, you guys grew up here, you know, where you were 10 minutes from a Walmart. I had to drive for 2 hours to get to a Walmart where I grew up, you know? So people think of California as beaches and, you know, San Francisco, LA, and they forget there's a huge, I guess, country Western portion of the state. But
yeah. Never stepped foot in there since I was a child in the state of California, so I couldn't tell you what it's like now, but you know, I remember some kind of like rural parts, and you know, although going to visit my grandparents in Thousand Oaks wasn't exactly rural either, so
yeah, Thousand Oaks, that's in Southern California, isn't it?
Yeah,
I spent some time down there going to college. I was all over that state, it seemed like.
I'm sorry.
Lots changed. I says I'm sure a lot's changed since you were there.
I'm sure.
I don't go back. I guess still got all my families there except for my little sister. But it's I don't go back. I've been back three times, and it's been for funerals or weddings. I guess you can call weddings funerals too, depending on your outlook on them.
Only if they get married during hunting season. So,
yeah. Agreed.
But let's kind of get into a little bit, like, did you start hunting when you were, when you lived in California then, or were you, how did that go?
Yeah, I grew up, so we're just kind of the nature of where I grew up. We lived on about a couple hundred acres, had a cattle ranch, and just in a really, really nice valley in northeastern California. And there was game abundant, you know, kind of a thing. And we moved up there when I was in second grade. So I pretty much my whole life grew up in that environment. And my dad was a big hunter, so was my grandpa. You know, everybody was. So as far back as I can remember, we always either had, me and my brother always had a BB gun in our hands or a 22. And much to the chagrin of the California Fish and Game, I shot just about everything that moved. Nothing was safe. My grandpa used to pay us a nickel for every bird that we shot because they were crapping all over his farm equipment. So we'd go out and shoot as much as we could, you know, and they didn't know any better at the time, I guess, but kind of grew up into that and watched my dad deer hunt and doing waterfowl, small game hunting. It was always kind of a natural progression to get into deer, and couldn't really hunt anything else. Bear at the time, you were able to run with dogs, but we didn't really know anybody that ran bears for dogs or bears with dogs. Elk was a once in a lifetime tag. Pretty much so as antelope, so it was basically deer. You were hunting deer if you were there, and hogs later on. I got into hunting hogs, but my grandpa took me out on my first day deer hunting and shot a little fork and horn with him, and then got another deer my next year rifle hunting, and then got into archery. So I've been shooting archery almost exclusively since I guess I was 13 or 14. And ended up getting into the archery tech side of things when I was in college working at Bass Pro Shops and then later Sportsman's Warehouse. But that's kind of how I got started in all that. But I kind of spoiled myself. So I 12 got a buck, 13 got a buck, 14 was my first year archery hunting. First morning archery hunting, like within the first hour, I think I arrowed a buck by myself, went back and got my dad, and he didn't believe me until he walked up and saw the buck. But I was like, oh man, this is easy. And then didn't get anything for years after that. But it, you know, I just thinking back of how much I didn't know about anything. My dad didn't shoot archery. Nobody really knew shot archery or was that much into it. I still remember shooting aluminum arrows. But it's came a long way as far as what knowledge you can get out there as far as tuning your bow and making sure everything flies right. I still remember just screwing on broadheads and thinking they were going to hit with my field points and then missing deer and going, what the heck? Why did I miss that? You know, but
you are not the only one, my friend. You are not the only one with that.
Oh, you know, because it says on the package, right? It says field point accurate. So you just, oh man, I could just screw on these, you know, NAP 100 grain thunderheads and no, man, I missed a buck on a water hole three times, just sailed each shot over his back, same spot, not thinking I should just Kentucky windage it and aim lower. But yeah, it's all because of that. You know, I didn't know broadhead tuning. Nobody ever told me anything about that. So
in your defense, though, there was also no range finders back then. There was definitely no fiber optic sight pins back then. They might have been like the plastic that was clear, so just a little bit of light might hit it on the tip. The ones that were so fragile.
Yeah, definitely wasn't the fiber optic wraps. I remember the old, I want to say it was a True Glow pin, but it was like a piece of fiber optic that kind of stuck up outside of the housing, and that was it. Like, there was no wrap. But
Those were high tech. Because I remember the ones I had a piece of like, some of them, it was like a piece of white and a piece of orange plastic. And it was like a little ball on the end of the pin.
They were huge. Like, everybody's like, oh, I can't shoot, you know, the 2.9, the 2.9 fiber optics. These things were like 5.0s, you know.
And then they'd always break off, get snagged on something and snap off. You get in your tree stand in the morning and look down as soon as first light came and look at your bow and go, oh, no pin.
Yeah. No full capture fallaways or that was even before whisker biscuit. So, you know, your drawback and your arrow would come off the bow and you'd have to put it back onto the rest. And,
yes. All of those mistakes were made. I'm pretty sure I did every single one of those.
Came a long way since then.
Heck yeah, we did. Yeah. And now so I'm too scared to even work on my own stuff, but I don't know why. But
it's easy to throw them out of tune now that I've kind of got into just tuning all my own stuff and doing all that. It's easy to, you know, you make one little tweak and it affects everything else. So it's kind of a snowball effect, I guess.
Especially the whole split limb thing with the shimming different cams and doing all that stuff.
Yeah, I shoot a Matthews, so it's got the top hats, and yeah, switching the top hats around and cam timing and all that. It's had my share of sleepless nights cussing at this thing, trying to get it all tuned after switching the strings out on it.
Nice.
Shooting good now.
So at one point, did you get into like elk hunting? When did that happen?
Until I moved to Idaho. I came up here with my dad as a non-resident to rifle elk hunt back in 2015, I think, something like that. Bought a couple deer tags and an elk tag when you could get a deer tag as a non-resident over the counter. We went rifle elk hunting. That was the first time I've ever really gotten elk hunting, but I never did see an elk the whole time we were up. We were up in the Panhandle area and with some family, you know, they were just basically like, drive this four-wheeler up into this clear cut and see if one steps out. And didn't know really much about elk hunting at the time and didn't see an elk, shot a couple nice whitetail bucks, but that was it. And when we moved up here, me and my wife, it was I was bound and determined to try to kill an elk. And first year, I didn't know what I was doing. Went with a buddy that was a non-resident guy I grew up with in high school, and you know, didn't know the area, kind of threw pins on a map, and I was wanting to hunt them like elk and like mule deer, which it's a lot like Brian Barney hunts. We were just talking about him, but you know, as far as being able to spot them in open country and kind of spot and stalk them and not call them, that's kind of more what I was trying to do, avoiding the thick dark timber. And then, you know, fast forward a little while, knowing more, I'm like, that's where I should have been. But I was trying to get into the open country and try to glass them like I do mule deer. So it that was a skunked year. But last year I was able to arrow my first bull, which was a pretty neat experience. A buddy of mine that I work with now, he was working for the local sheriff's department. He's pretty much determined to get me onto a bull. He never took his bow off of his pack until I killed my bull, which was pretty special. I can't thank him enough for that. But
so, I mean, what else did you learn that, like, you were totally doing wrong when it came to trying to get, you know, on an elk?
So, and it's kind of what we were talking about, gear-related stuff, is I'd sent my buddy a list of gear. Like, hey, this is what I'm got. I mean, down to the, you know, the old Excel spreadsheet with the weights and the prices and what I was using down to socks, you know. And I made sure on there was a pair of gaiters, and it was that year. So it was 2 years ago. It was a super rainy year. It rained every day that we were in the elk woods, and my buddy didn't have gaiters. He had waterproof boots, but he didn't have gaiters. And not knowing how important that was, he didn't know any different. And we spent every morning hunting, but his feet were so soaked. You could hear him walking next to you. It was just so soggy, his feet. And you know, and that's a miserable way to hunt, and that's not something you can do the long term. And so we had to pretty much every day, half day, go back to the truck. I didn't have a stove for my teepee, so we had to basically start up the truck and dry his boots out every day. And so we were like, oh, while we're in the truck, we might as well drive around and look at this new spot. So I was going spot to spot to spot every day, only hunting in the morning, because by the time we drove around and got to the next spot, it was almost too late in the day to hunt. And so that really took a lot of time away from our hunting experience and not really getting able to know an area. And like, I know you know who Mark Livesay is, but his e-scouting stuff is it. You know, going to the Western Hunting Expo and actually hearing him talk and then getting one of his master e-scouting class and going through that right now. it's everything that he says to do, we were doing the exact opposite. We had no plan. We didn't have any, you know, my maps weren't downloaded. I had my maps downloaded, my offline maps for the one spot that we were initially going to go, but nothing else. And so we kept having to drive back to cell phone service and wait to download maps to go to this new area. And it was just absolutely a nightmare. And it was, we did it to ourselves. And I think that preparation of having that e-scouting done, having those multiple spots to go, and really the gear. After, I think, day four of all that, we finally went to a local kind of an outdoor store and bought him a set of gators. And he was fine for the next 2 days. But we had already dug ourselves such a hole that, you know, we couldn't get out of it.
That osmosis really pulls it into your boots, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was, and he was cussing his boots and like, they say they were waterproof, I'm gonna send them back. And I'm not gonna say what brand they were, but they were, you know, a reputable brand. And I was like, dude, it's not your boots, it's not coming in from your boots, it's coming in from your, you know, everything else from your knees down that's hitting this wet grass and brush and everything. And it was, you know, he just had never worn gaiters, so he had no idea how the impact that this thing can have.
Yeah, it almost makes me want to get a taller pair of gaiters. Because I've got like the mid, the mid knee, you know, or not mid knee, but like the mid shin, you know.
Yep. Oh, okay. Not the ones that go right to your knees.
No.
Okay. Yeah. That's. And people give me a lot of crap for it, but I wear gaiters even if it's not wet outside or snowing. I've actually had a few times where wearing those knee high gaiters, I wear the First Light gaiters, has probably saved me from impaling myself on some deadfall. Just gives you that extra little bit of, I guess, toughness layer that those branches can't poke through, you know, falling into deadfall and getting jabbed and having a real bad scratch and a massive bruise on my leg, but it didn't puncture. And I almost guarantee it's because of those gaiters. And so I hunt in so much deadfall area that I pretty much wear those things no matter what. And they are hot. They do make you sweat a little bit more in the heat of the, I guess, season, but I know if I sit down the glass, I open them up and air everything out so it dries, but it's something you got to keep conscious of.
No, that's a good thing to think about. As I think my first one, I brought them on the hunt, never actually wore them, left them in the truck, but I was lucky that it never rained or snowed or did anything. Mm. So, I mean, I would have been screwed if it, you know, would have been out somewhere and did that, but especially cold weather, it makes it worse, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't just leave them out and let your boots dry while you're glassing for the morning, you know? It's, although those, have you seen those new Graxaw boot dryers?
It's like a little battery pack or something that goes on them, like a cell?
Yeah, it's a little fan that's about like that, yeah, and you plug it into, you know, Poseidon Energy or some type of a battery pack, and it just a little fan that blows, and they're really lightweight.
So is there a heating element in them, or
no? There's not. It's just a little fan, and there's two of them, and they're real thin, they're real lightweight, but they're I know like Brian Call and Lampers use them. I got to see them firsthand and at the summit, but they're, you know, just to get that air circulating through those boots to dry them out a little bit more. It might be worth, I think, I don't even think they're 6 ounces. You know,
nice.
It might be worth that. You know, when you're not running, using a stove or something like that, in the, that you can dry out that stuff. At least a little bit of air circulation has got to be better than just leaving them sit there.
No, absolutely. Anything would help, right? I know I've seen some guys do like hand warmers. They'll take some hand warmers with them and throw those in.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know what would actually work. I've never tried doing that myself, but.
Yeah, I did that 1 year because my boots got wet. They weren't like wet on the inside, but they were constantly wet on the outside, and it was down into the teens, so they were freezing. And, you know, I don't like starting off with super cold boots, so I just leave those in the toe box area, those hand warmers, and it, I think it got them warm enough to where they were able to dry a little bit, not be frozen in the morning when I put them on.
Nice. But no, that's pretty
good. I don't know how much they worked for drying things, but it sure made it a lot more comfortable putting my boots on the next morning.
For sure. So let's get into, so let's flash forward. What did you do differently from learning your mistakes, not doing everything you did, and then going into last year where you actually got your bull?
I guess being into elk, my buddy helped a lot. Yeah, he was like at the time. So I met him in the spring of 2019 after I killed my spring bear. We were talking, he was working at the sheriff's department at the time, but I'd already bought my elk tag for that year and planned my hunt with my buddy. He and this kid, his name is Chris. I call him a kid, but he's 24 years old. He's just 10 years younger than I am, so I call him kid.
That is a kid.
Yeah. he is a lot more mature than I was at his age, so I'll give him that. But now he'd been hunting this area and he invited me to go, but it was too late that year. So flash forward to 2020, already had that area picked out. You know, we knew where we were going to go. He had since transferred over to my department and was in the field training. So he couldn't take days off because he was doing the whole FTO gig and academy. So I knew I was going to be going into this area by myself for the first few days. And then on the weekends when he was able to get out, he was able to come up there with me. But I knew I was going to be in elk, and I really concentrated on finding elk. I mean, you can't kill them if they ain't there. So getting in a country where there was elk, the thick north facing timber pockets that I was avoiding the year before, was getting into this next year. Worked on my calling a lot and just really getting into elk. And I had some pretty close opportunities before he showed up, but he's a really good caller. He's been hunting elk a lot since, I mean, he still is a kid, but been hunting elk a lot longer than I have. And so even though he's only been archery hunting for a few years, he grew up elk hunting with a rifle, but he knew elk, he knew their behavior, he was a really good caller. So, and I got to give him so many props. His attitude is so much better than mine. And I've been working on that a lot. And that's one thing that's probably my fault, is that my attitude, I could get pretty pessimistic, even in the elk woods or even in the woods. And that was one thing that, sorry to digress from the story, but that's part of it.
I told him.
That's one thing I told him this year I was going to work on, and it definitely made our spring bear hunt a lot better. It's just my attitude and knowing that's my flaw I got to work on. But I had gone in the first night by myself, a couple miles in, and go down to start eating my dinner, and I forgot my spoon. So here I am, you know, from the truck where my spoon was, I was like 8 mile four-wheeler ride and then a couple mile hike, and I'm sitting there already hearing elk bugle my first night in there. I wasn't gonna go back out to the truck and come back. I was too excited to hunt the next morning, so I stayed and I kind of didn't really think much of it. And I'm such a like, how can I fix that and do this and tinker with stuff. I never thought about how to make my own spoon or to, you know, to get by without it. I just figured, I don't know what I was thinking, but I wasn't thinking at all. But I was like, I could just live on the snacks that I brought. That was a big mistake. After 3 days, 10 miles a day, you know, thousands of feet of elevation, just chasing elk all over, I bonked like I've never bonked before. Like, I didn't think I was going to make it out of this hole. I was so bad, you know, just lightheaded, dizzy. I'd take a couple steps and, you know, have to like sit down because I was getting so lightheaded. Every time I drink water, I'd throw it back up. Like, I was in a bad way. Like, contemplated sitting there on the side of the mountain, like, man, I might have to hit my SOS button on my inReach. Like, I was not good. But I knew I was going out to meet him at the truck, and I could get my spoon or I could get some more food in me. I think I only had like 2,500 calories in 3 days. And so I was just working on,
that's terrible.
People eat like 3,000 calories a day without all that strenuous activity.
Yeah.
So I was just, I had wore myself so thin that finally get some food in me. But Chris gets there, you know, his first time hunting that season, elk at least, and he's fresh, he's in shape, he's 10 years younger than I am. And I'm still, even though I had two of my peak refill meals at the truck, like, I was still, you can't just make up that type of caloric deficit in one meal. And so I was just I was smoked, and we get in there and I'm in a bad mood because I'm smoked and he's like wanting to go back down into these nasty holes that I was just in and barely made it out. And he kept a good attitude and he pushed me to go after. And I called him the Phantom Bugler because he's 24. He's got good ears. I've been in, well, now 4 shootings and have a lot of hearing loss and supposed to wear hearing aids, but I didn't bring them on this hunting trip, and I will now bring them because I didn't realize what I wasn't hearing. And you know, he'd be like, "Oh, you hear that bugle down in the bottom?" And I'm like, "BS, dude. You ain't. I didn't hear nothing down there. I'm not going down into that hole." You know. And so we end up going out. We're going back to the truck. I think it's day 5, and we're driving the 4-wheelers back, and I'm still smoked. Looking forward to getting to the creek by the truck, kind of refreshing, getting some food in me. And he stops in the middle of the road and I'm not happy, right? I'm just pissed. And he's like, "Man, I hear that there's people hear bulls in here and they see bulls in this drainage." And I'm like, "Dude, it's right next to the main road, like, or not main road, but like main 4-wheeler trail. Like, people drive by this all the time. There's not bulls in here." It's like, "No, let's just see." So he lets out a couple bugles, and sure enough, he hears one way down in the bottom. It's like, "Oh, did you hear that bull?" Again, I'm like, "No, I don't hear nothing, dude." And so I'm still pretty pissed at this point. And he's like, "No, no." He rips another one. And then this next time, a bull answers closer, and I actually hear it this time. And we look at each other, and I was like, "Okay, I heard that one. He's closer." He's like, "I think we could kill that bull." And I don't know, it's just, I got a rush of energy that I didn't have before. And so we made a play and kind of snuck in. It sounded like the bull was bedded. It was about, I don't know, 11 o'clock in the morning. So we make a play down into this bull. And as soon as we dump into the timber, we jump this massive velvet buck. I mean, this is September 5th, I think it was. And buck is still in velvet. We didn't get a good look at it, but we were both like, "Oh, that's at least a 180 buck. Just a really nice velvet muley." And so I'm kind of focusing on that, like bird in the hand versus, you know, two in the bush. And I know this buck didn't bust him hard because, you know, he was ripping bugles and we were kind of walking like elk. So he just kind of gingerly went off. So I thought we can get in on this. So I'm kind of sneaking through the timber trying to get back on this buck, and he's still calling and ripping bugles and everything. And I end up seeing the buck again at like 80, can't get a shot at it. And then we go back down to where we last saw the buck, thinking I might see him again. Didn't. I set down my pack and my bow and going to have a snack. And he's still in elk mode, and I'm about to eat a snack mode. And again, because I can't hear anything, he hears something and he's like, "Grab your bow." And I'm like, "Okay, grab my bow." I'm like, I think he hears the buck coming back or something, you know. And it's like, "He's coming in." I'm thinking still the buck. It's like, "Where's he at? I can't see him." He's like, "No, there's a bull coming up the draw." I couldn't see him based on where we were. He could. And so this bull's coming in. I still don't hear him. My buddy sees him. And all of a sudden he goes, "Come on, let's go." And we take off running. We leave our packs and we take off running kind of down this draw after this bull that I still don't see. And he tells me to run ahead of him. And I go ahead towards this kind of a knob, and he hangs back, and I peek over the knob, and I see this bull at the bottom of this bowl at 64 yards. And it's like, "Oh crap. Yeah, there was a bull." You know, and I range him, gonna shoot him there, but he had kind of turned and then started coming back up the draw. My buddy's calling was working. This bull still hasn't made a peep, no bugling, no nothing. Starts coming up the draw. And as soon as I could see his royals come up over the brush, you know, thirds, as soon as I see his seconds, I kind of knelt down and drew, and then I crouched, full draw crouched. And as soon as he came up a little bit more, I just stood up and worked through I probably just jerked the heck out of my hinge release, but it was a frontal at 12 yards. You know, that's not a whole lot you can do to miss at that point. And, hit him frontal and watched him die 10 seconds, you know, right in front of me. And it's one of those experiences I'll never forget. Nice. And it legitimately is all just because of my buddy. Like, there's, you know, having him there to push me more than anything is I probably would have packed it up before that. I was just mentally not there, and he was, and he pushed me to it.
So the lesson there is what?
My nutrition, you know, and I guess I took it for granted. I don't think I've ever pushed my body to that point during a hunt before. And just, I think I took the nutrition for granted instead of like, no, it sucks. I might have to miss the morning hunt, but I got to go back and get my spoon. That's a decision I regretted for a while after that. It took me a while to
so get that energy back. But I'm just wondering why you didn't take a stick and whittle a spoon for yourself.
Dude, I don't know how many people, people call me MacGyver because the way I take stuff, but they're like, really? You couldn't have. And I was like, dude, there's a 10 things that I could think of right now that I should have done. But at the time, I don't know why I didn't think about it. You know, it was like, I'll be okay until I can get back to the truck. And then it just hit me like a ton of bricks that last little bit.
I think I might even hydrated before that food and cut the pouch off so it was shorter and you could just dump it.
And just drank it. Yeah. Oh, that was one of the 10 things that I should have done that I thought about. Like, holy cow, I could have just, it's basically a soup anyway, most of them. So I could have just, drank it and been better. But yeah. Now the nutrition,
power of positive honestly, my thinking.
Buddies, yeah, gotta... no, my buddy's outlook on everything and his good attitude killed that bull. You know, instead of a "nah, we can't get to it" or "no, nah, I'm too tired," it was a "no, we can go do this." And you know, I've always pushed my body as far as limits goes, playing college sports and everything else. But that was I even pushed it past what I originally thought I could, and you can do a lot with you know what's going on between your ears, I say. So that was absolutely definitely one of those lessons that
I've been trying to push myself mentally more and more, because I realize, you know, physical is super important and sometimes I'm lacking in that area, and I can beat my body up and do something as long as I push my mind to force me through it. So
I think your mind will fail long before your body will.
Yeah.
And that's and I got to get better at that. That's along with the attitude thing too, you know, and being a good hunting partner. I haven't been hunting with other people for very long. Like, I was a solo archery guy because my dad didn't start archery hunting until I was in college, but you know, I was by myself hunting. So it was never I never had to ask or bounce ideas off anybody. I just did what I wanted to do because I was the only one out there. And so hunting with somebody else that also had good ideas about what to do was something that I wasn't used to. And I butted heads. My buddy that I elk hunted with my first year elk hunting when I moved up here, that I said we just got skunked on everything. He's a very strong, opinionated person like I am, type A personality kind of guy. And we almost started fist fighting on the mountain. And we laugh about it now, but there was a point we almost went to blows just because I wanted to go this way, he wanted to go this way, or we had a different thought in our mind on which way we wanted to go and how we wanted to work our way through this timber. And it was, you know, he's the same way. He solo elk hunts and I solo hunted. And so it was just, I didn't really realize it until this winter, I don't know. Wintertime, I usually reload and tinker with my new loads for the rifle for the year. And I'm reloading, listening to the podcast, and I can't remember whose podcast it was, but it was about being a good hunting partner. And they talked about all this stuff, and I'm sitting here freeloading like, holy cow, this podcast is for me. I am the exact person that they're saying you don't want to be, you know? And I had that oh shit self-reflection moment that I think will pay huge dividends in the future as far as hunting. Like I said, this spring bear hunt is one of those that it paid off big, and it was so much more fun and rewarding because my job, I'm stressed out all the time, and hunting is my release. It's my reset. And why did I bring that stress, that amount of stress level up there on the mountain that's supposed to de-stress and release all that stress? And so it was really like a wow kind of a moment that I had. And I don't know, hopefully going forward I can get as good as I can at that. And I tell my buddy, I'm like, dude, call me out on it. If I'm being that guy again, like, just blatant call me out. And I need that to happen people need to call me out when I do stuff like that, because it's sometimes we're our worst enemies as far as our attitude.
So my buddy Johnny Mack is one of the most positive people I've ever talked to in my life. Anytime you hang up the phone after talking to him, you're smiling just because of the positivity that comes through that phone when you're talking to him. It's crazy. But it makes me think, though, that's the kind of person that you need to, you know what I mean? Like, you need to be sometimes. And I find myself, you know, if I'm negative or whatever, I'm like, man, there's no reason to be like that. You know, it doesn't pay off any way whatsoever.
No.
It really doesn't. But so I try and be more positive like Johnny and think things, the power of positive thinking, as he says. So it seems to help, and I'm going to continue to do that. And maybe you'll continue with the power of positive thinking, man, as well.
Yeah. I love what Johnny's doing over there with his podcast and the Soul Seekers and all that stuff. Like, that's, like you said, that dude is just positive to the T and great mentor for anybody that's looking to get into hunting and everything. You know, that's, I wasn't such a good mentor. Just like I said, I was a big solo guy, and so hunting with somebody else was a tough hurdle for me to get over. And especially a younger guy, you know, a guy that's 10 years younger, that I have all this experience of mistakes that I've made, and I'm trying to tell him, let's not do that. And instead of hearing what he has to say and knowing it's not the same situation, that he knows what he's doing, trust that he knows what he's doing, you know, I'd lose my temper, and I wouldn't lose it for that long, but I always had those snaps, those, you know, passive aggressive asshole moments that, you know, that just, it's a drain on the hunt. It's a drain on his positive attitude and what this hunt could be. And it was I wish I could remember what that podcast was or whose it was, because I'd sure love to give him a lot of credit for it, because it's
I know the podcast you're talking about, and I've listened to it too, and I couldn't tell you who it was, but I know I've listened to it, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's the definition of a crappy hunting partner for sure.
Man, I'm telling you, everything that guy said, it was me, and I was like, wow. So my buddy's been hunting with me for, I don't know, however many hunts, and he's been dealing with that, and has still kept a positive attitude and not called me an asshole to my face. Like, dude's even, you know, his attitude's even better than I thought.
So are you guys going out, though? Are you guys going to go out this year together?
Yeah, he's able to. He's off the field training program and out of zone and doing really well. And he's able to, we actually are both able to take a bunch of time off. We usually reserve a lot of it for spring bear and then elk hunting. But we're both, I took off, I think I'll be off from the August 31st to September 21st.
Holy cow. Nice.
Yeah, I'll have to come back. I've got a 5-month-old boy and my wife at home that I'll have to come back for, but I believe I'll be able to be out there from the 31st till I think September 11th, and I'll have to come back for a few days to watch my son while my wife works, and then be able to go back out for another few. But Dennis Stokes should be joining us on that one too.
That's awesome.
That'll be a lot of
that's
fun.
Exciting. So speaking of Dennis, you're a gear junkie. What is your favorite piece of gear? Is it your initial ascent pack?
Man, I love that pack. It's hard for me to put a favorite on anything, because it really depends on that always goes with me no matter what hunt I'm doing. But you know, I put backpacks, I put boots all on in the same, and then your weapon system on like even tier, when people are like, oh, what's the one thing I should spend money on? You know, it's like, well, I can't just say one thing, because you could buy a really nice backpack but shitty boots, and you're going to have a miserable time. You could buy really nice boots and a shitty backpack, and if you do kill something, because that's the goal, and you're going to have a shitty time. Or, you know, weapon system. If you don't have a good weapon system, you can't capitalize on those opportunities. So I do love that pack. It is, it's been so much better. I had a lot of bad experiences with prior packs that I was, Chris, the guy I hunt with, actually was the one who turned me on to initial scent. He's been using their packs, and a friend of Dennis and Joe's for pretty much, I think, after only a few months of them being in business, and brought his pack over one day after I had a bad experience with my previous pack packing out my bear, and just tried it on with a lot of weight in it. It was just night and day difference. It fits my body, that lumbar pad, everything. Just the more weight you put in it, the more it just sticks to my back, and just it's been it's been a blessing, that's for sure.
You can
and
say then, your mystery you know, ranch sucked. Nobody cares.
I'll say it because I don't mind talking crap about it.
Because mine did.
It was a Kuyu. It was the Ultra frame or the Ultra suspension system that I had. It was a Kuyu. I think at the time I think it was the 3200 bag or something. I can't remember, but it was just miserable. And that thin, the narrow frame and the thin frame, and then not much of a lumbar pad. Just, and it felt great with, you know, you're walking around 30, 35 pounds. It always squeaked, and I hated that.
That's the same with the Mystery Ranch. Always squeaked.
But it once I put that bear on it, all it was boned out meat and hiding heads. So there's no structure to it. And I didn't have the Kuyu load shelves, but I was doing the whole wedging the meat against the frame. And with camp and everything else that I had in the bag, and it sit so low on my back, and then just not being able to secure it because of how narrow the frame is. I mean, if you think about it, that initial scent pack, it starts up really wide and then it tapers down a little bit narrower, but it's still at its narrow point. It's still, I don't know, 10, 12 inches wide. If you think about it, what do we carry weight wise that's narrow? You know, like the Kuyu frame. I mean, it's that, you know, nothing you carry, your quarters, your game bags, everything is wide. And so that wide frame on the initial scent, it just cradles that meat and that load really well. And it keeps it above my waistline, which is huge. And it just, you know, your knees, your joints are still going to feel it, but not having to overexert yourself to control a load that's slushing around on your back. Like that bear I packed out, it was just over a mile, and it was a really easy kind of a flat downhill pack out because I killed him right below a creek drainage that I could just walk out. But it just about killed me. I was had so much back problems after that until I got to the chiropractor. Just it was miserable. But I've had such a good experience with this pack, and I know you use one, but there's a lot of different. People's bodies are different. You know, it's like when you see the arguments online of, oh, this pack or these boots, the boots one is the funniest thing because everybody's like, nah, it's Zamberlin's, nah, it's Crispy's, nah, it's Hoffman's, nah, you know, and it's almost like
fits you.
Yeah, right. And my feet, you know, like Crispy's, I didn't like the way the Zamberlin's fit me. You know, some people might love the Hoffman's, or you know, it's all personal preference. When you get to those top tier packs, it's like when I used to sell archery equipment or guns for that matter, you know, it's like I could, you know, I'm a Glock guy. I like Glocks, just shoot them in law enforcement, and they've always done me really well. But if I went to sell somebody a Glock and they're like, oh, I don't like the way it feels in my hand. Like, cool, that's your personal preference. Don't buy a Smith & Wesson Sigma. Buy something comparable as far as price-wise and quality-wise, but find something that fits you, that feels good to you, because what feels good to me might not feel good to you. And with archery equipment, it's worse. You know, and we shoot ourselves in the foot with this whole as a hunting community. You know, if you don't wear Sitka gear, you know, shame on you. Or, you know, if you don't shoot a Matthews bow or, you know, whatever, but... So we kind of divide ourselves based on what gear we run, which is kind of sad sometimes. But, you know, my buddy Chris, he just bought a PSE Evo, the 34. Love that bow. I shot it in my little garage shop thing that I got here. And it's a great shooting bow. You know, I love that thing. I used to talk so much crap on PSE when I worked in a bow shop. I used to call PSE piece of shit equipment. Like it was... It was always a joke, but I shot for Bowtech at the time, and you know, I was a Bowtech through and through. And it's not a good way because some people didn't like the grip on the Bowtech, or you know, and it's just so much personal preference that I think as long as you buy quality, whatever fits you and feels good to you, it's your. Nobody can tell you any different, you know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure all them bows are pretty equal these days. I mean, you might have some that aren't, you know, but. basically once you get into that certain price range, they're all going to be about the same. I mean, they might, one might be a little bit louder than the other one, but one might shoot softer than the other one. You know, it's 100%. All going to vary.
They all got their pros and cons. You could sit there and make a list and compare them each. And it's funny watching some of these bow reviews online that are like, oh no, Matthew's run one third year running. And it's like, and I know guys that can't, that hate the Matthews, the way, you know, how front or top heavy it is and wants to fall forward at, you know, just the balance of it, whatever. People have their own personal preference, but like you said, that price range, that price bracket, you know, don't go by, you can't compare $100 boots to $300 boots. You can't buy, you know, compare, you know, I always talk crap about Badlands because I've had them, I've owned Badlands packs, but you know, you can't compare Sports Warehouse $250 Badlands to a $700 Kafaru or Initial Sin or Stone, or you know, yeah. You can't. There's apples and oranges, and same with, you know, weapon systems or anything else. Optics are a big one. You know, you gotta, what's in that price range? Buy what's the best you can in the price range that you have, and like you'll be surprised stepping up the price bracket how much better it is than the next. There's a reason why it's a little bit more expensive. It's not just because they can do that. It's, there's comfort reasons and other different reasons why they have multiple price brackets. So
did you get a commission? I got to ask you this. Did you get a commission when you were selling the firearms?
So
the reason I asked that is because why would you put them in a Glock if you could put them in like a Les Bear or something like that?
Yeah. Well, again, price range, you know, you got guys who are coming in there looking for their first gun and, you know, the Nighthawks, the Les Bears, you know, the Wilson Combats, that's somebody knows what they're doing when they come in and ask for that kind of a gun. You know, that's not something that your first time gun buyer is going to.
No, but I would have been the guy.
Hey.
Oh, man. You got to hold this. Check this out. This is the one you.
So that is funny you mentioned that, because having worked in retail, I pick up on these things when I go in and I, you know, kind of do my window shopping at some of these retail stores. And you go in there looking at a certain optic and everybody's always like, oh, you got to look at these Swirros. You know, they're $2,000 more than you're looking for to spend, but you know, gotta look at these, you know, like, dude, I know what you're doing. You can keep those Swirros in the, I know they're better. Trust me, if I could afford them, I would buy those, you know? So it's, I know that game, but they did, you know, there was, some of the manufacturers on the firearms would, do monthly incentives. So if you sold, you know, Smith & Wesson was one of them that could come to my mind. You know, they just came out with the M&P series not too long before I was working at the gun store, and they were like, oh, if you sell 10 M&Ps this month, we'll give you an M&P for free, you know? So that's a huge incentive for me that, you know, like somebody comes in like, I want a 9mm. Look at the Smith & Wesson, you know? Like, oh, well, I heard about this Glock. Nah, you don't want that. You want the Smith & Wesson. And so I have a hard time knowing all those kind of the things that go on. Sending anybody to a retail store to look at something, I always tell them like, hey dude, if you need to go feel something, like, you know, a rifle, for instance, if you want to feel how it feels in your hand, feel how the bolt actuates, feel how the trigger is and everything, go to these stores, do it, but do your own research. Don't let these guys, because I'm sure they're still doing that type of a thing where they get a kickback if they sell this or whatever. And so I have a hard time. And like I said, I cut my teeth on in retail, but it's I've seen a lot of kind of shady stuff going on as far as that goes, where it's like, this might not be what's best for the customer, but hey, I just upselled, you know, upselling them on something, you know, but you know.
So with that being said, if somebody's going to look for a gun, you want something reliable, you want something that probably will fit your hand depending on the generation, just buy a Glock.
Yeah.
Just buy a Glock.
Yeah. You know, and
no, there's no sponsorship here.
Yeah, they've come a long ways since I was selling guns, as far as, you know, now they have their slim frame series, like their single stacks, like the 43, the 43X and stuff like that. And that was a big thing with smaller statured people being able to get their hands, because the Glock is a blocky, you know, and the grip angle on a Glock was usually hard to sell people to if they've, you know, they don't have the 1911 grip angle. So a lot of people, oh, this feels weird in my hand. And so, you know, it's like, hey, if it's not comfortable to you and you can't get to the trigger properly, and being a firearms instructor, that's a big thing, is being able to get on the trigger and having it comfortable in your hand where you can have a good solid grip. You know, a lot of guys will have to cock their, kind of break their grip. And so the recoil is just on their thumbs to get to
the mag
trigger, especially on a Glock. You know, yeah, or mag release,
I still have, like, to shift my hand on the mag release, but
I do,
you know,
too.
What? It is what it is. Yeah. I've adapted.
That's and I don't even think about it anymore. You know, it's just, you do it enough, you just do it. But I build Glocks. I build polymer, you know, Glocks on polymer 80s. I like, I'm a Glock armor. So the least amount of parts that are in a gun, like a Glock like that, they're the, you know, they're very simple. They're easy to work on yourself. I was a SIG armorer too at my last agency, and those SIG, we shot the 226s. And
a lot of parts.
Holy cow, a lot of parts, a lot of little parts, and a lot of parts that broke. Those things were very unreliable. We shot old ones though. They didn't.
No, I think the new ones, I think they've come a long way as far as 100%. Repeatability, the dependability of them, for sure.
This is how old the ones that they issued us were at my old department, is they were German SIGs, so they were made in West Germany. They didn't have a light rail on them, and they didn't have night sights. So, or the night sights that they did have, the tritium was so old in them, they weren't night sights anymore. So they were very old, and they needed a lot of parts replaced, but the power of money that they didn't want to replace all the parts. So we were having parts break. That's right. You know, guys at the range are like, hey, my gun won't shoot. Oh, your hammer spring's broken. You know, it's like, oh, that's not a good feeling, you know, and they were armored every year. So it's like, you know, they were 40 cal. So those, that caliber or that cartridge beats up handguns quite a bit, but yeah, I wasn't a fan of the SIG 226. I know I'm going to probably catch a lot of crap for that because I know I got buddies that love them, but
what, bro?
Yeah. Oh, dude. Yeah. It's like everything. Like,
here comes
by this 226,
the forums blowing up.
Oh, dude. Yeah, that it's all about what fits your, and I like the agencies that are like, hey, as long as it's, you know, 940 or 45, carry whatever gun you want that's within these parameters, because, you know, you might shoot a Smith & Wesson M&P, great, or you might shoot a SIG 226, great, but you might not shoot a Glock very well. Well, why would I throw a Glock in your hand if that you're not very good with that firearm? I want you to have, as an agency, I want you to have what you could shoot with the best, because you're going to be comfortable with that gun and you're going to be the best shot you can be with that firearm. And, you know, there's limitations, like everybody wants to carry a 1911 or a 2011. And I love those guns. I just don't know if there's a lot of room for them in law enforcement. I have a couple of them.
Only
carry
if you're
off duty sometimes and stuff, but yeah, right. Hey man, I do love those guns, but there is, it's hard going from a Glock or even that SIG 226 to shooting. I used to shoot at USPSA competitions, single stack division with my 45. And there's a couple times where you getting on that trigger, because the trigger being so much different than the SIGs, that you were getting on that trigger, you know, preloading it as you're coming out and torching off around before you wanted to. And it's not a good feeling. But yeah, there. So I that's mainly why I stick with Glock. Just it's my comfortability and the training of it. I've got so many rounds downrange with a Glock and being comfortable with it that I don't have to think about it when I go to draw. You know, if, heaven forbid, I have to have an off-duty incident where I have to defend my life or somebody else's life, I don't want to have to think, okay, which gun am I carrying today? Is it 1911? You know, so. It's just a continuity of training when it comes to all that stuff.
So let's transition a little bit and go back to boots that you mentioned. You said you went from what to crispy, because I'm just kind of curious, because I was using the Mindel whatever, and they were actually really good boots, almost too firm of a sole for me, kind of like Kenetrex are just too stiff for my foot. Yeah. they're too stiff. It's like I can't, you can't really get any feeling of what the terrain you're on or any of that kind of stuff. And I do like a medium sole, but those were definitely too firm. And then so, and I mean, they lasted, the Mindel lasted a long time though. I think I got like 3 years out of them, a couple hundred miles every season, and still had the waterproofing after 3 years, which was pretty good.
Yeah.
But so then I just bought a pair of Zamberlins. I got the Trail Light somethings. But so I have wide toes and a narrow heel. So it's kind of hard to get fitment that's good. I like the stiffness of the sole of the Zamberlin, but they put this like structure on the inside of the boot in between the layers of like the leather and the inside of the boot right in the toe area. So whatever this structure is like squeezing the crap out of my toes and I can't wear them for more than a couple hours. And I've even like, I've soaked them with the garden hose, tried to break them in, and whatever that structure is, it's like rubber or something inside there, and it's just not going to give me the flex I need. So now I'm going to have to buy another pair of boots.
and that's tough because, and Crispies are, I like the way they fit my feet, and they have a flex rating. They'll tell you on their website or, you know, Black Ovis or wherever you get them, what their flex rating is. And so I always had that problem too. I always used to use just, found them at Cabela's or Bass Pro or whatever. They were a Wolverine hunting boot. You know, I didn't need anything. Hunting in California, where I grew up, was kind of rolling lava beds, sagebrush. There wasn't like the high country, you know, above timberline, alpine kind of stuff. And it was hot. We hunted them in August, so we were hunting water holes a lot, or walking, you know, slow hunting patches of timber. Or there was a lot of lava beds, and the bucks loved to bed in these lava beds. So we would slow, kind of still hunt these lava beds. And so I wanted a soft sole. You know, we weren't doing some nasty, strenuous uphills, downhills, and stuff like that. It was a pretty flat walking. And those lasted a long time. But when I came up and went elk hunting that one time with the rifle, I think 2015, we were hunting some nasty stuff. And boy, those things did not help my feet. So when I moved up here, I bought some Crispies. I went around. There's a couple local stores that got Crispies, and I was able to try some on. And I started with the Summit GTXs. I think they're a 3-flex rating, which is kind of mid rating for them for the flex. And they do a really good job. They're not too hard. They're not too soft. You know, when you're walking the antelope country, flatter kind of stuff, they don't kind of fatigue your legs because you don't have any flex. You got the flex still in them, but they're still stiff enough for the nasty stuff. And then I bought a pair of Brickstalls for they're 4-flex. They're an insulated Brickstall. They're 200 gram insulated. Just for the winter hunts. I mean, like I said, growing up where I did, it got cold, but we were never hunting in the cold. We were hunting in August, so I never needed any insulated boots. And the first year I hunted, you know, an October deer hunt or even into the November hunts, I was like, what is this? Hunting in snow and stuff? Like, this is never had to do that before. So I had to get some. My feet, I know that is a big thing about my hunting is my feet, my foot care. It's I know I got feet that are prone to blisters and hot spots, and so I try to prevent that no matter what boots I wear. I just know it's just like my feet sweat a lot, so that moisture in there just does some serious rubbing, and no matter how tight I get the boots or sock liners or not, it's just I know it's coming. So I either I would put Leuco tape on all the hot spots that I knew I was gonna get before I left the truck. So I would pre-do it with Leuco tape just to prevent, you know, that. So I didn't get up, you know, a couple miles in and go, okay, I'm getting a hot spot now, getting out and putting it on there, try to stop it before it started. And that helped a lot, knowing I knew where I was going to get them just based on how much my feet sweat. But then guy from Western Contours got me onto this stuff. I thought I had some laying around here, but I don't think I do. It's called Rue Woo Wool. Don't try to say that too fast. It's like W U R U wool. And it's, I think it's a merino wool, but it's a just a chunk of wool in a bag. And you take it off and you kind of place it on those hot spots and slide your sock over. And my problem with a Leuco tape is after, you know, unless you wanted to strip it off every night, reapply it every day, I always just left it on. And after a while, if it's just getting wet, it would kind of migrate a little bit. It lasted quite a while, but it would eventually migrate. But that Ruru wool kind of adheres to, you could take your sock off and it stays in your sock where you put it. And so you can, and I would always peel it out of the sock and reapply it. You could reapply it. You didn't have to rip off new stuff and reapply it. And man, I used it all during the bear hunt. And my buddy Chris, he was having some hotspot issues and gave him some of that. And it really helped him out too. So, and how light that is compared to, I used to carry a full roll of Leuco tape with me. Just that's how much I used it. And, but that pack of wool, I just rip a big chunk off and put it in a Ziploc bag. And it's, I mean, I hate saying it weighs nothing because it obviously weighs something, but it's, I don't even think it would register on my scale. It's that light.
You probably could have fashioned a spoon.
Yeah, right. Yes, I should have. But yeah, and that's what I like about the Crispies. And I actually wear a Crispy. I think it's the Sniper for my work boot too. It's just I've had really good luck with them, and I have had to use their warranty. The rand was kind of peeling off. The one sent it back, no questions asked. It got fixed and back to me within 2 weeks. You know, nice. I never would have known it happened. So that is a nice thing. But I do like how they're. I think my next ones are the Laponias. I think they're a 2 flex rating, just to, you know, wear around range boot. You know, even hunting on them. I know Lampers like the Laponias, but
I hate to say it, but I think I might have to jump on the Crispy train here. I've tried them on before though, and I don't know. It might have been just the ones I tried on. They felt super comfortable, but then again, the flex rating of them. I mean, I had to drive all the way down to Springfield, which is like 2 hours, I don't know, 2 hours, 15 minutes away from me, just to try them on because nobody else carried Crispies, you know. So I went down and tried them on, and then I was like, you know. And the flex rating must have been, because I felt like my feet would just get super fatigued from all the flex on the sole, and I wouldn't have enough arch support, you know, would just wear me out. And so I was like, I'm staying away from the Crispies, and that's when I bought the Mindles. And then now I'm kind of thinking maybe I ought to give Crispies a try again. Although, I mean, you know, I'll have to get a flat brim hat and, you know, like once you go down that road and start wearing medium Husky t-shirts, you know, I just.
Oh, man. Yeah. We're three quarter length sick of puffies. And
Right. Or the new, sleeping bag slash onesie snuggie or whatever.
Yeah. So my buddy that I hunt with, I give him so much crap. He's a good sport about it. But he was wearing First Light stuff when I first met him when we were hunting together. And then he wanted to try Sitka stuff. And he is such a snob when it comes to different camo patterns or just different brands wearing them, that he sold all of his First Light stuff down to the T, everything, sold all of his First Light stuff and bought all new Sitka stuff. And, you know, he got those 3/4 length fluffy pants, and he will never admit that I was right, but I would give him so much crap about that. I was like, what, just the bottom quarter of your leg doesn't get cold, or what? What's that about? You know? You're supposed to, you wear them with your gaiters and this and that and the other thing. And I was like, that's cool. I could wear my full length puffies with my gaiters too. You know? And then one trip he forgot his gaiters and he was running around with his 3/4 length puffies on. I was like, how's that bottom of your legs feel? And they're fine. They're warm. And yeah, he was never going to admit that I was wrong. Right. But I'm pretty sure he was getting cold.
Nice. Have you heard of Forlo?
Forlo?
Yes, For the Love of Hunting, American-made hunting, technical hunting apparel.
New
to the game.
I think, do they look like the ASAT camo, the First Light ASAT camo?
Kind of, yes.
That kind of that Predator camo, real big blotchy pattern.
No, I wouldn't say that because it's like it's blended.
Light, but it's a light tan base with almost like a tiger stripey type of a pattern look.
No, I wouldn't say that.
No. Okay. No. You'll have to send me their stuff because I saw an ad for a company the other day.
So my thing is I've been slowly trying to replace out anything and everything I could with American made gear slowly over time. So I'm not going broke and my wife kills me, you know, whatever.
Right.
But,
but
trying to do that. And, one of the things I came across because I was like, you know, my Sitka pants are kind of starting to get, I had the Timberline pants and they're starting to get a little worn out. And, you know, I was thinking they're definitely faded compared to the jacket that I never wear. But, so that's the other thing, like camo doesn't matter. Colors don't matter, you know, but whatever. So I was like, you know, starting to get worn out. I'm going to replace the pants. So then I started looking, doing a little bit of research and came across this Forlo and it's made in America. I was like, how can I go wrong with that? They're actually super badass pants. I like them better than the Timberline pant. So if you're in the market for a new pant, just saying, they've got a lot of stuff that they have plans for. It's just not made yet. You know, you got to try and get the name out there before you can make, you know, 2000 different SKUs. But, but so like, it's pretty basic what they have right now, but they do have down puffy layers, I may consider, but the pants are pretty badass. I'm totally digging them.
Do they have the vent zip on the side?
They do.
You know?
They do.
Oh, dude, I like me some of that. That is.
They have a vent zip. They have knee pads integrated in. They have a...
Are they removable?
I don't think they are, but they dry quick because I have had them wet. And so they DWR treat all of their fabric before they put it all together. So highly water resistant, and it's already a water resistant material anyway. And the way they do the DWR, though, is they put it in like a giant, it's like a Connex that's a vacuum. So they put it in there, the material in there, they DWR it, and then they pull the DWR through, so it's still water treated, but it doesn't clog the pores of the fabric, so it's still breathable. Super important. So,
yeah,
pretty neat. I wore them all last season deer hunting, went through mud and muck and saddle hunted, so I was up scraping and climbing on my platform, so all the abrasion from that. And they use this stuff that was like from the automotive industry for the knee pad, like the scuff pad on the outer layer of your knee. Super durable stuff. I thought a couple of times I was for sure going to tear them open, you know, just stupid stuff climbing in and out of the tree. And
sharp saddles, your knees are on the tree though.
Yeah.
All the time.
Sharp gear. And they held up. So I was pretty impressed. So it's, something to look into if you're looking for, because I know you're a gear junkie like I am. So,
Do they make a merino base layer?
So, technically, no, because merino is not American wool, right? That's like New Zealand wool,
Australian, or
So, they're working on something right now that it will be Montana wool, which still has the same rating and everything as the actual merino does. So they're working on something that's supposed to be coming out. I don't know when that's dropping. I'm super excited about that. But they do have another base layer now that's called Trizar, which is the same stuff they used to use on the space shuttles. So it actually dissipates heat, but it also retains heat all at the same time. So it, like, it's a thermal regulator, I guess you would call it. And it's got like anti-stink properties built in to the, whatever the fabric is that you're using. It's automatic with that. So I do have the shirt.
That's my thing. It's the sweat. Yeah. I like my feet. I sweat and I stink quick with a synthetic. That's why.
Yeah.
I like the,
I haven't gotten any stink on. So I only have the top, but I will say that you could wear it a couple days. I haven't worn it like super long, and plus, I mean, it's pretty freaking cold in November here, but yeah, I don't know. I haven't really put it to the test yet in like warm weather, I guess. But
yeah, and that's, I did a test with Merino, actually my first light Merino Aero Wool 150 top, wearing a vest all the time in the heat for law enforcement is, as soon as you put the vest on, you start sweating and you don't stop sweating until you take it off. So you know, 10, 11 hours, you're sweating in that. And man, it was with a synthetic layer underneath or cotton. I used to stink so bad. And
yeah,
you're the worst, you're your worst enemy. So all that comes right up. So you're smelling this the whole shift. And I was like, you know what? I use this Merino wool stuff to hunt with because it's antimicrobial and,
right,
you know, kind of odor resistant. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to try it. So I wore that underneath my vest first day. Didn't stink at all. And as soon as I took my vest off, it dried real quick. I was like, okay. For the second day and a third day and a fourth day and a full 5-day work week without washing it, which some people are like, what the heck? That's, yeah, it probably wasn't the most sanitary, but just to see if I could get it to stink. And it never did stink. Full 5 days of wearing the same shirt, sweating in it all the time in that vest. I was like, holy cow, like this is how much better that is than the synthetic to me. And I know there's other synthetics that have different coatings or stuff that they impermeate the synthetic with to help with the odor. But I was sold on Merino after I did that.
Now you just inspired me. I'm going to have to take the Trizar shirt, the base layer from Forlo. I'm going to put it on and I'm going to run for a full week and then see.
There you go.
Don't wash it. Yeah. Don't wash it and see what it does. But I think
your wife's not going to appreciate that one.
She doesn't care. But I appreciate you coming on and talking to me. I think that's probably a good point to wrap it up because we could probably go on forever. But
We could talk. Yeah, we haven't even scratched the surface on a lot of this gear stuff that I got sitting over here. But I know you got to get some sleep. It's what, 11 o'clock back there?
Yeah, it's getting there.
Yeah, dude.
So we can. We could probably have another discussion another time and we'll really get into some more gear. But
definitely.
So people, if they want to kind of follow you and you're starting the whole Gear Junkies Anonymous thing too, where can they find all that and do all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. On I got a Facebook, but I'm not on there as much, but on Instagram, Backcountry_BABA_YAGA, Backcountry Baba Yaga. A lot of people pronounce it funny, but it's kind of a play. You ever seen the movie John Wick?
Yes, I was going to ask you that. Was it either like the John Wick character, the killer from John Wick, or was it like the old ancient Russian folklore about the woods dweller?
So it's more the play on the John Wick thing about the, you know, he's not the boogeyman, he's the one we send to kill the boogeyman, kind of a thing. So that's kind of where I got that. But and then, Gear Junkies Anonymous on Instagram, too. I have that one. That one's just kind of up and going. I haven't really spent a whole lot of time and effort on that one yet, but it's getting there.
Nice. I appreciate it. Thank you for coming on, man.
Hey. Oh, thanks, buddy. I appreciate it.
Once again, thank you so much for listening to the Publicly Challenged podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to. Also, if you could leave a review, that would help us out. And you could check us out on Instagram or at publiclychallenged.com. And once again, thank you so much for listening to the show.